All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.
Good morning. I'm Angela Davis, and you're listening to NPR News. Glad you could join us today. All this week on this program, we've been listening back to some of the conversations we've had on our show over the past year. Today, producer Maya Beckstrom is joining me to share some of the shows that stood out to her over the past year. Good morning to you, Maya.
Hey, good morning.
So one of the major stories of the year has indeed been COVID-19, and you picked a show that you produce that touches on COVID. Tell us about that.
Well, we've done so many shows on COVID, and most of them have been with doctors. So we've brought on infectious disease doctors and virologists and many experts to help us understand, you know, kind of our risk and vaccines and how to treat this. I picked a show that's a little bit different. This one ran at the very end of September when this most latest wave of COVID hit us. And it was about when the hospitals first began getting really slammed. And we wanted to really bring forward the voices of doctors, nurses, other hospital staff who were on the front lines and just getting hammered by this. So that was the show I picked.
One of the questions we often get is, like, how do we go about finding guests? How do we pick the guests that end up on the air? What can you tell folks about that?
Yeah. Well, for this one, kind of two extremes. One of the ways we do it is simply to call communications folks. So all the institutions out there, hospitals included, have PR teams, and we call them, and they're our friends and help us sort through finding the best people to talk about something. So I definitely did that. Ended up getting in touch with a doctor who works for Centracare, which is up in the St. Cloud area at the St. Cloud Hospital. And then in talking to him, he mentioned a couple of nurses who he worked with, one of whom had taken a mental health break because things had gotten so difficult in the ICU. And so that was a case of just reporting, hey, can I get a hold of that person? Can we reach out to her?
I remember the show distinctly. Remind me again of who the guests were, again, their names.
We're going to hear from Dr. Jacob Lyons. He's a critical care physician at St. Cloud Hospital, one of the main health hubs in the Centracare health system. And then also from Sarah Spilseth, who's the chief of staff at Regents Hospital in St. Paul. And we're going to hear first from Annie Gazinski. She's the nurse I mentioned who was taking a break from working in the ICU at St. Cloud Hospital. She'd worked there since 2008 and through the first 18 months of the pandemic.
Well, things have basically gotten so stressful and kind of almost overwhelming at work to the point where it's hard to function even when you're outside of work. You're in this state of being on high alert every second. It starts affecting every aspect of your life, and it's hard to enjoy your family and your friends. Then I knew it was time for me to take a break, take care of myself for a little while, get things back together so I'm ready to go back and be in that environment again.
That makes sense to me. And I want to hear more about the environment, Annie. Why has caring for some COVID-19 patients been so difficult now? You know, I've read that lack of trust has been an issue and the interactions between nurses and patients has been hard.
Yeah, that is completely true. For most patients, you know, if I say 5 years ago, I can walk into a room, educate them about their illness, tell them what's going on. They believe what I say. They're thankful for the care that they've been given. And now it's almost the complete opposite of that. You walk into the room and you can just feel people staring daggers at you. You try to kind of explain what's going on, what's going on with them, you know, how much oxygen they're using, and they don't believe anything I tell them. So it is incredibly frustrating and just like deeply sad. People are just so misinformed that this has become a political dilemma instead of a healthcare dilemma, which is what it truly is.
So Annie, as an ICU nurse, have you had to put patients on ventilators who were extremely ill from COVID?
Yep. We do that almost every day that we're at work, actually. And surprisingly, it's almost a fight with some people to get them on the ventilator. They're so hypoxic and when your oxygen levels get so low, you almost get delirious and people are crawling out of bed and just so confused. So you literally have to sometimes lay on people to get them to stop moving. Because, you know, every time they move, their oxygen levels get lower, while people can help you get things ready to get people intubated. And there's also different times before you intubate people where they have a moment. We let them call their families generally to talk to them, to say their goodbyes, because no one ever knows when they go on a ventilator if they're going to, you know, make it through this or not. We don't know. They don't know. So we generally allow people to have time to say goodbye to their family if time allows for that. And it's sad and incredibly sad in those moments. You have empathy for them as they're saying goodbye to their families and, you know, wishing they, you know, would have gotten that vaccine or would have done something different, and realizing the entire significance of what's going on. One patient actually stopped and thanked me before we intubated him for the care that he received. And it was just so moving to know that someone in their last, you know, few seconds that they would be conscious and alert and alive, they spend that time thanking you for what you did. That's kind of changed a little bit with this new wave with the types of patients we're getting, the, you know, the ones that are kind of against vaccination and COVID. But I always think back to that moment. We all need to, you know, still be compassionate for each other, but that's just getting extremely difficult.
Well, Annie, I appreciate that you recognize that you needed to take a break to take care of yourself, because I can't imagine dealing with those types of scenarios, you know, during a shift and then returning home and, you know, going through your daily routine. So what is your home life like?
I'm married. I have two children, two dogs. I'm also in nurse practitioner school at the moment, so it's pretty, pretty full. My son also has COVID at the moment, so he's kind of, he's doing okay, thankfully, but it's always a lot going on, but nothing ever feels impossible the way that work feels impossible. I was talking to one of my friends, and as we were kind of discussing things, she told me, like, no one signs up for hopelessness, and that's what you are doing right now. Every time you come to work, you know that, you know, no matter what attitude and you try to have when you come, that you know you're going to be put into a situation where you don't have enough staff and the patient load is going to be too much. And you almost leave every day feeling like that you failed, no matter how hard you try. That sense of satisfaction from my job is now gone. I used to be able to come to work and, you know, that I would have a workload that I could handle, be able to use my intelligence and
your training,
critical thinking skills, and right, and training and assessment skills. And it seems like none of that matters anymore. No matter how good I was at my job, it doesn't seem to make any difference now. You just feel like you're scrambling constantly.
Annie, stay with us, and I appreciate you sharing so much of your personal experience. I want to turn to our two doctors now. Dr. Spilseth, you're there at Regents in St. Paul. You're the chief of staff there, but you're also caring for patients. How are you doing?
It's a stressful time. I worry so much, and I'm really glad you had Annie on today. Mm-hmm. Our critical care nurses, I worry about them. They are in a really tough spot, but it's not just them, right? Mm-hmm. It is everyone at the hospital, from our nurses to our doctors to our respiratory therapists to our nursing assistants to our physical therapists to our transport people. Across the system, we're feeling this. It is a really stressful time. Our teams are working longer hours. They're picking up extra shifts. And it is, Annie, you brought this up, it's hard to turn it off at the end of the day. It's really hard after you have been literally managing life and death all day to then go home to your family and try to lead this normal, quote-unquote, normal life. It's hard to shut it off. And the thing is, you know, when you come back tomorrow morning, it's going to be more of the same. And the thing that is harder now than ever before is that a lot of these COVID cases are absolutely preventable.
What do you mean by that? Because the vaccine is now available and many of these patients are unvaccinated?
Exactly. The vast majority of patients we're seeing here in the hospital, and certainly those who are in the ICU, those who are on the ventilator, are mostly our unvaccinated patients. You see that they're gambling with their lives. We know that had they made a different decision 6 weeks earlier, we may not be in this situation.
Dr. Spill says, I know that some of the patients who have died are relatively young adults who were not vaccinated, and that has to be especially difficult to deal with.
That is where I think this next wave has been even more difficult. Is earlier on, it was a lot of older people, people from long-term care facilities, people from transitional care units. Now, they're people my own age. I can relate to these people. It wasn't too long ago we had a patient. She was a 30-something-year-old female who chose not to get vaccinated because she thought she was low risk. But unfortunately for her, it didn't work out that way. She didn't make it. And what made it even harder is like her daughter is the same age as my own. This 8-year-old girl is now going to grow up motherless. And the mix of emotions that goes with that, there's this anger that, you know, it didn't have to be this way. But in the end, it's profound sadness. I just can't even imagine. It's a little bit too relatable as my own daughter turns 8 next week. Just to imagine, you know, this poor little girl at home, when she turns 9, mom's not going to be there with her.
We're talking about what it's like to work in healthcare right now in a clinic, in a hospital. I want to talk to a couple of listeners right now. In St. Paul, we have Bethany on the line. And Bethany, what do you want to share with us?
Hi. I'm a little nervous when I talk on the phone, but
okay.
I just wanted to call in because this is so important. And I'm a medical interpreter. I freelance throughout the Twin Cities. And what I've seen is what you are talking about, the receptionists and the individuals who are at the stations to ask the COVID questions have just been getting so much abuse. And it was very poignant one day when I was in line behind somebody who was giving the poor woman difficulty. She was very polite. And I came up next and I said, I know you have to ask the questions. Thank you for doing your work. And she burst into tears. And as an interpreter that goes around the Twin Cities, I get kind of a bird's eye view of what's happening at the front line of just the receptionists mm-hmm. and service people. And it's just overwhelming to them as well. Mm-hmm. Everything you're talking about is so profound. And I wish that people would stop thinking about worrying about losing their personal freedom and remembering that we're Americans. And part of what we do as patriots is take care of one another.
Thank you, Bethany. So many people traumatized right now in Minneapolis. Let's take another phone call. Steve is on the line. Steve, what do you want to share with us?
Hi, I'm an emergency physician at Hennepin County Medical Center. Mm. And we all are very distressed, not so much because we are stressed, which we are, but because so many patients don't have access to care because patients who are unvaccinated are occupying hospitals and emergency departments and ICUs all over the state. For instance, a small hospital in northern Minnesota had a patient who had acute spinal cord compression. It didn't have anything to do with COVID. But this doctor called many hospitals all over the state to try to get transfer this patient because his little hospital can't take care of this major problem. He couldn't find anyone to take the patient. The patient had to wait in the ED, in the emergency department, for 12 hours. He called me. We don't have any beds at Hennepin. I said, call Abbott, call North, see what they say. He called them both. Neither had any beds and rejected his transfer. He called me back and said, okay, we don't have any beds, but we'll take him anyway because we will help out anyone anytime when necessary. But we didn't really have the resources either because we had 40 patients waiting to get into the emergency department at our hospital, as every hospital in the Twin Cities has six-hour waits in the emergency department because hospitals are overcrowded. But we did accept this patient. But there are patients all over the state with severe problems, severe illnesses, not related to COVID, who can't get care because all of these unvaccinated people are occupying hospitals. They have not done their duty as citizens to stay vaccinated and stay healthy. And they are the cause of all this trouble in the state. And I don't think people know how much trouble there is in the state, how ICUs are full everywhere, how patients can't get the care they need. And we are distressed because there's so many innocent patients who can't get the care they need in every hospital in the state.
Steve, thank you for calling and sharing that. This is also troubling to hear and distressing. Thank you for your work as an ER doctor there at HCMC. Let's go to another part of the state. In Ely, we have Nate on the phone. Good morning, Nate. What do you want to share?
Good morning. I'm also an emergency room physician, or I was until July. Mm. I made a decision during the lull in the springtime to quit because of everything they've been talking about. For 25 years, I worked evenings and nights, and then during all of this, you'd be going into work and thinking, at least let's get rid of this so that we can all get our lives back. But there's no compassion on the streets. And they're not wearing masks. They're acting like it's all over. They're going to Sturgis and the fair. And I want to do those things too, but we can't. And now we're locked down again because nobody really cared enough and thought, well, I don't have to get my vaccine and I don't have to wear a mask. And then they'll take care of me when I get there. And like the ER doc from Hennepin said, there's just no beds. And that's such a complex issue, but it's really disheartening to not be able to give the care that you want to and that you did for so many years.
And that's why you decided to quit, Nate?
It was the lack of beds and the lack of the function in the hospital. Mm-hmm. And it's burnout in the larger sense.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Nate there in Ely, a former emergency room doctor who just left his job in July. I want to get back to our third guest. We have Dr. Jacob Lyons with us, a critical care physician there at St. Cloud Hospital. Thank you for holding on. And Dr. Lyons, we've heard so much already in just the first few minutes of the show. How are you doing?
I want to echo both the callers and Dr. Spilseth and Annie. We're struggling. We are collectively, we're burned out. I think that's a good word to use by Nate up in Ely. Mm-hmm. Every day at work is a grind. We see folks who are by and large unvaccinated, and the heartbreak that comes from knowing it didn't have to be this way, and knowing that these folks didn't have to die or didn't have to be critically ill, is really, it's wearing on our team.
And Dr. Lyons, that is the big difference from where we were a year ago, right? Because a year ago, the vaccine was not an option.
Right. So a year ago, we had this, both within the hospital and as a society, this collective desire to roll up our sleeves and get through this. And that is, as many folks have pointed out, that has largely gone away.
I want to hear about your interactions with some of the unvaccinated patients who are now seriously ill and in the hospital. What are those conversations like?
We see a range. There are folks who are defiant to the very end that either COVID is not real or not the cause of their critical illness. But there's a significant percentage of folks who show real remorse, who will say that had they known it would be this bad, they obviously would have gotten vaccinated. They would do anything to avoid this happening. And those are the folks I feel for the most. Those are the folks who, either they got bad advice from a friend or a politician or a talk show host and decided that they didn't need to be vaccinated or shouldn't be vaccinated. And now some of them have died. And many will have lifelong physical impairment, largely to their lungs. Many have expressed remorse at infecting their family members, their children in some cases. And those are the folks I feel the worst for.
I don't want to leave everyone feeling hopeless right now, although this has been a very difficult conversation. But, Annie, what would you say to the public? Like, what can we do to help? Because we can't have our healthcare workers all leave, but we also can't expect you to continue to live your lives like this.
I've been thinking about this a lot, as a lot of my neighbors and friends have chosen not to get the vaccine. And really, all I could say to them was, you know, you're living in a part of a society that you have to follow, you know, you have to follow traffic laws. You have to wear pants into a store. There are so many parts of being in a society that you have to, you know, follow some amount of rules and some amount of mandate, especially if you care about the people living next to you.
That was from a conversation we had this fall when Minnesota hospitals were hit with the latest surge of COVID cases. Healthcare workers continue to be under strain, and Annie has since returned to the ICU at St. Cloud Hospital. This is NPR News, and I'm Angela Davis. Now back to the conversation with producer Maya Beckstrom. This week, we're hearing from some of our show's producers and revisiting some of our shows from 2021. Today, producer Maya Beckstrom is joining me to talk about some of her favorite conversations from the past year. Now, Maya, tell us about the next show that you picked up.
Well, this one is about an almost universal experience among immigrants. It's about losing the language that's spoken by your parents or your grandparents. And I got the idea from a column in the Star Tribune by columnist Laura Ewan. She happens to be our former colleague here, yes, at NPR News. Yep. Mm-hmm. Laura wrote about a post on a Hmong mental health Facebook group that was written by a Hmong American named Ia Zhang, who's a psychologist here in the Twin Cities. And Ia had written about language loss as cultural trauma. And then Laura, you know, added to that her personal experience. And it just, you know, it struck a chord for me.
Yeah. What is it about it that touched you? Why did you want to pursue it more?
Well, I guess it made me think about something that I hadn't thought a lot about, which was my own sadness at not speaking one word of Finnish, which is the language of my maternal grandmother. And I can only say, you know, a table prayer in Swedish. And my grandfather on my mother's side immigrated from Sweden. And I guess I've had some sadness about that. My mother doesn't speak the languages either. So it got lost really quickly.
And so then this is personal to you. You're interested in learning more. How do you go about picking the guests for this show?
Yeah. Well, I knew I wanted to have Laura on, obviously, to kind of kick us off. And then also Ia Zhang, the psychologist who she was also writing about. And then to flesh it out and give some history, because we love to bring history and context into our shows. I called around and I found someone named Jenna Cushing Lubner, who's an assistant professor of multilingual language education at the University of Wisconsin-Whitewater. And she researches the loss and also how to reclaim heritage languages. So we'll hear from her a little bit later in the segment.
I remember this show well. So let's take a listen. I started by asking Laura Ewan why she wanted to write about this topic.
I mean, it's something I've felt kind of in the background my whole life, I would say, starting as a little girl and realizing that I, unlike some of my Asian American friends who are the children of immigrants, was not fluent in another language. And as I wrote in the column, it's like this weird sense of shame that follows me even to this day when I walk into a Chinese restaurant and, you know, I can exchange pleasantries, but not really much beyond that. And so when I saw this Facebook post that Ia Zhang had written, where she directly addressed Hmong kids who aren't fluent in Hmong and said, look, this is not something to be embarrassed or ashamed of. It's not an example of a personal failure. It's an example of the sense of loss that many of us carry. I mean, it felt like she was speaking directly to me. Mm-hmm. And even though I'm not Hmong, I'm Chinese and Taiwanese American, I just felt so seen. And I knew that there was something here and something that would probably resonate with a lot of people one or two generations in.
Absolutely. So you're sort of constantly always processing this, but not always talking about it. So tell us a little more about your experience of growing up as a child of immigrants.
Oh, sure. So growing up, because my mom is from Taiwan and spoke Taiwanese and Mandarin, and my dad spoke Cantonese, they only spoke English in the house. I mean, that is the only language they actually have in common. So that's why, you know, my brother and I didn't, we weren't really exposed in the household to other languages. Now, of course, when I went to my grandma's house, I would hear Cantonese, and I do love that feeling. It brings me comfort to hear those, you know, those like explosive tones of Cantonese. It's not that they didn't want me to learn Chinese. I mean, at one point, I remember they did send me to weekend school to learn Chinese. But like by that point, I was like 10 and I was literally placed in a classroom of babies.
You had a big baby?
Yeah. And it was like so humiliating. And then I tried again and went with a girlfriend who was also Taiwanese. And I remember, you know, just like you do in the mainstream school, we would go around taking turns reading passages from a book. And I was like a straight A student, you know, in mainstream school, but in Chinese school, I was like a flunky. And I just felt like such shame because those characters in Chinese on the page meant absolutely nothing to me. And I just felt so embarrassed. And but like I said, when I saw this post, I was like, yeah, I've been carrying this for a long time. It's time that I explore it.
Well, let's talk about the Facebook post that you are mentioning. You inspired this column by Laura Yuen in the Star Tribune with your post on a Hmong mental health Facebook page. And you wrote something about Olympic gymnast Suni Lee. Tell us what happened to Suni and why did that strike a nerve with you?
Yeah, so, you know, being Hmong American, obviously, Suni winning an Olympic gold medal was such a huge deal for the U.S. and especially within the Hmong community. And so all around me, I saw how proud everyone was, just kind of, you know, watching all these interviews of her. And there was then one particular interview where she was asked to kind of speak to the Hmong community and to speak in Hmong. And Suni immediately appeared a little bit uncertain and almost embarrassed about her ability to speak. So she said, you know, one quick line in Hmong. And, you know, social media, you can kind of just like read people's reactions and Hmong folks from all over the world just commenting on her inability to speak Hmong and even questioning if she was Hmong, like almost insisting that if she's not able to speak Hmong, then she's not Hmong or she can't represent being Hmong. And so I just initially like saw myself in her. I saw myself in her in the sense that I grew up feeling embarrassed and ashamed that I couldn't speak Hmong in a way that would, you know, in a way that I could really express myself to the elders. And then also hearing a lot of the criticisms, I think, of just not being able to speak Hmong from Hmong elders or the Hmong community. And, you know, I think just feeling that sense of shame kind of everywhere, because it was like I was going to a school in Spokane, Washington with mostly my white peers, and I was speaking English all of the time. Mm-hmm. And just, you know, speaking whenever Hmong came up, it just was something that folks would look down upon. So I would have like be made fun of when people would hear my parents speak Hmong. And so it just felt like every space that I was in, whether it was at school, out in public, or at home, or in my community, it was like I just felt this deep shame for my inability to speak Hmong or, you know, trying to speak Hmong.
And so I'm hearing these words, embarrassed, ashamed, guilt, a lot. Laura, you used, you know, the phrase, the collective heartache. The response to the column, is that what you're getting from people now, that there is this collective heartache over this issue?
Yeah, that's kind of what surprised me, is just how widely resonant it was, even among folks who'd been here, like, say, three generations in from their own immigration story. So folks whose families are European American, you know, they remember their grandparents like having a rule in the house, like no German can be spoken here, you know, because of societal pressures at the time, especially. And I think that, you know, what Ia has been able to do is to speak directly to this generation and say, you know, the problem is not you. We need to encourage our young people to have confidence in this language and to try. Like, we can't keep shaming them. If the end goal is to further fluency of our cultural language, then we need to be more positive about how we embrace young people for trying.
I want to talk to some of our listeners. So right now in Madison, I want to take a phone call from Sam. Sam, what did you want to share with us about this?
Hi, Angela. Everything that your speakers have said really resonates. I am a child of immigrants from the Middle East, and they found their way to Iowa, where I was raised. And as you can imagine, in Iowa, there's not a huge Arab population, and so I kind of, over time, just never really learned Arabic. And in addition to that, what your speakers were saying, the shame and grief that came with that really resonates. When I talk to my grandma, having to like ask her to repeat herself in English, it just makes me feel bad. The experience is shared here.
All right. Thank you, Sam and Madison, for sharing that. Let's bring in Jenna now. Jenna, you're an assistant professor of multilingual language education at the University of Wisconsin-Whitewater. Jenna, what we're talking about, it's a common experience of many immigrants. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is really, I mean, the history of language loss in the United States is really the history of the United States. I really appreciate what Lauren and Ia have already said, especially talking about this idea of collective heartache and shame. When we think about language loss in the United States and the history of language loss amongst indigenous language speaking communities, African language communities brought through enslavement, and then every single generation of immigrant and refugee origin communities. I mean, this experience is really about trauma, right? So I think Ia talked about this as like intergenerational trauma in her post. And when we think about language shyness or language shame and that actual physical freezing up when it comes to using your own family or heritage language, that's really the embodied response of trauma experiences. And it's our vagus nerve, you know, being kind of acting up and trying to protect us because there's been so much danger and violence that has been experienced either personally or across the generations of our families when it comes to using languages that aren't English in the United States.
I've heard about the vagus nerve before in other conversations about trauma. Can you explain more about that? It's just sort of like the body's emotional response.
Yeah, I mean, it's more than that. So the vagus nerve is one of our like kind of ancient systems in our bodies. And what it does is when there is real or potential threat, it freezes our bodies up to protect us, right? So if you think about this fight, freeze, or fawn response, so if there's a dangerous thing happening and we ourselves can't fight it off, we will do these different things. Like we might freeze up and hope that that dangerous thing will pass us by, right? Literally, if I stop talking and don't use my voice, maybe this attack on me won't happen, or maybe they will ignore me and pass by. And that turns into language shyness, that stuttering of when people do speak your language to you, your family or heritage language, your body actually getting in the way and saying like, I'm not going to do this. And it's really a protective response that is so, so deep in our systems of freezing ourselves up in order to not be in danger.
Jenna, tell me, why does being American get defined as speaking English and only English?
Absolutely. I mean, the formation of the U.S. As a state followed a European model that came out of feudal systems that turned into nation states. And what held a people together was a shared language. So the boundaries of the state of France were drawn around like who speaks French, right? Those French people understand each other. They are the French people, the boundary go around that. The United States was trying to really like create a way to say like, this is how we live together. This is how we agree that like, this is our country. But it was really rooted in a very small number of landowning European elite English speakers saying, this is our country. And so determining that English is going to be the way that we communicate with each other is really about maintaining power dynamics that have long, long histories of a small group of people being in charge and staying in charge.
I want to take more phone calls right now as our phone lines are filling up as we talk about losing the language of your parents and your grandparents in St. Paul. Pam is on the phone. And Pam, what do you want to share with us?
Good morning. Thank you. I'm a Ojibwe woman, and our language has been lost. We're losing our elders. And when I started when I began trying to regain my language, which was very hard because we didn't have anything written. We heard what people would say, and on my reservation, I would say what they would say. I would go to the different reservations that are from the Ojibwe Nation, and I would get shamed. I moved to the cities, and I was able, there was a written language, there was people that cared to bring this language back, and I started working with that. And I wasn't shamed. They told us not to shame, just continue to go. You may not know to say it correctly, but you're trying. And like I said, I'm a 65-year-old woman. I'm learning my language. I have children that are 40, 30, and 20, and I'm teaching them that. Every time I write, every time I say anything to them, I try to say in Ojibwe, and I also write it in Ojibwe to them as well, so they can recognize it. And that's my story.
And then, Pam, what power, Pam, what do you feel, what power comes from that? Is it about identity and pride?
Yes, it's pride. It's pride being able to do this language. I mean, I'm not fluent, but I'm learning. Mm-hmm. And not having somebody shame me for something that I've said. It is. And we have a very supporting community here. And we're trying to teach our children. So it is pride. Right. And it's wanting to go out and teach and loving our community.
Thank you. That's Pam in St. Paul. Ia, what do you hear in Pam's story? You're a psychotherapist. You work with a lot of families who probably talk about this. What do you hear in Pam's story and in her voice?
Just totally resonate with her story. And really what I hear in that desire to continue on the language is it truly is about healing. And kind of like what Jenna was speaking about, how this language loss really is just an example of a community's trauma and loss. For me, being Hmong, our culture is a very oral tradition where we learned all of our cultures and wisdom in the oral way of storytelling. We didn't have a written language. And so it's so much loss in that and grief and trauma. And so that ability to kind of recognize that for what it is, and then to find that sense of peace and healing to say, I want to reconnect with the language and to be able to share that with my community and with the next generation is really healing. And I feel like that's what the emotion that comes up that I kind of hear in that desire to reconnect with language.
That was from a conversation I had earlier this year about a column on language loss written by Star Tribune columnist Laura Ewan. I'm talking with producer Maya Beckstrom about some of the shows that she produced this past year. And Maya, what else have you picked out for us?
Well, this last one is, kind of a squishy topic that I've been thinking a lot about over the last couple of years as we've been thinking about racial reckoning following mm-hmm. George Floyd's murder. And this is one of these shows where I had this idea in the back of my mind for a long time. I wanted to talk about bias and prejudice, wasn't sure how to do it. And then this book came along that was written by Jessica Nordell, who's a Minneapolis science and culture journalist. And she released a book this fall called The End of Bias, A Beginning.
And so, yeah, she's a local person. She lives here in the Twin Cities.
Yep.
What did you hope that listeners would get from this show? Because the topic of bias is not a new one, and there have been lots mm-hmm. of conversations about it.
You know, I was really hoping that this would let us think about ourselves and kind of get inside our own heads and begin to understand some of the assumptions and expectations and stereotypes that everybody carries around. I mean, we have these, we can't escape them, and I thought this might be a way to help us become more aware of them.
Here is author Jessica Nordell defining bias for us.
Unconscious or unintentional bias. What we're talking about is this kind of specific phenomenon that happens where we grow up in a particular culture, and as a result, we learn the categories of people that are kind of salient or relevant in that culture. And along the way, we also learn associations and stereotypes that are connected to those categories. And what happens in the case of what we think of as unconscious bias or unintentional bias is that when we encounter a person who we recognize as belonging to one of those categories, all of those associations and stereotypes that have been stored up in our memory can start to influence the way that we react to a person. And they can influence the way we feel, the way we talk, how we behave, how we evaluate the person. And the thing that's kind of unique about this kind of bias is that it can happen really automatically and really quickly, like so quickly that we don't even necessarily realize that we're being influenced. Mm-hmm. And additionally, it can really conflict with who we believe ourselves to be. So we might think of ourselves as really egalitarian and fair-minded, but then behave in a way that totally contradicts that.
Jessica, we're already getting phone calls from folks, and I want to bring them in early as we talk about bias and how to identify it, what it is, and whether or not we can, you know, address it. In Minneapolis, Mark is on the phone. And Mark, what do you want to share with us as we discuss bias?
Hey, thank you so much for taking me. I think this is really fascinating, and I want to just give you a little background to explain. I've lived like over 30 years in North Minneapolis. I grew up in rural Iowa, raised my kids, I mean, right a few blocks from North High. And so they've grown up in the community. And so we've lived in a community as a white family and a predominantly Black community. I've dedicated most of my life to addressing bias issues, trying to teach other European Americans about it. So several years ago, when my son was in high school, I was driving home. I was driving down Emerson Avenue right near Broadway. Many of you might know the area. And it was dusk. And pulling up toward the light, I'm still about a block away. And I can see there's this young man, and it's, you know, can just see silhouettes coming off the curb and obviously like walking towards my car. And I can see he's in a hoodie. He's got baggy jeans on. And immediately I felt a little nervous. And I knew I shouldn't like panic, but I felt some nervousness. And then I pull up and I realize it's my son who wants to ride the rest of the way home. And I think to me, I remember that story because it just shows as much as we try to identify and deal with our biases, there's things that we grew up with.
All right. Well, Mark, I want to go back to something you said. Three things I heard there. Young man, hoodie, and baggy jeans. And then it caused you to have a feeling.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that feeling was fear.
Yeah. And it was like, why is he walking through it? And this nervousness, you know, and it was just a split matter of seconds until I realized it was my own kid. But it just caused this nervousness for a second. And yeah.
It stuck with you. Jessica, what do you hear there in Mark's story?
It's so interesting. And I think, you know, that point about feeling is really important. There's a lot of research that suggests that the way we feel is actually a stronger predictor of how we behave than what we think. And feelings come up so quickly and so automatically, like the guest suggested, that it's incredibly powerful and can be extremely dangerous. You know, when if we react to those feelings without taking some time to really investigate where they're coming from.
So how does someone know that they're being perceived or treated differently than someone else? I mean, you can't really know, can you?
This is one of the biggest challenges. And, you know, because we each only live in one, you know, we're inside of one body.
Right.
Body. Exactly. And, you know, one of the things that can be so challenging about this kind of more subtle bias, or not necessarily subtle, but unintentional or really sort of automatic bias, is that we don't always know. And there's research that finds that like facing this kind of bias, this sort of unintentional, unconscious bias in, for instance, a workplace, can actually be more challenging for people to deal with than overt discrimination, because it's really hard to figure out what's going on. And people then start to ask themselves, wait, am I making things up? Am I imagining it? Right. Maybe I'm overreacting. So it's extremely challenging.
So what are some of the studies of bias that have really stayed with you as you wrote the book? We know that bias shows up in schools and workplaces, in policing and healthcare. But what are some of the studies that stand out to you?
Oh, my gosh. There are so many that are so stark. There are actually many studies that show disparities in the way Black patients and white patients are treated. And the one that stands out is about vascular disease. So there are studies that show that Black patients with vascular disease are more likely to undergo an amputation for a limb as opposed to a limb-sparing treatment when you compare them to white patients. And that's even taking into account things like the severity of the disease, insurance status, the quality of the hospital. And it really, I think, shines a spotlight on essential questions about what, you know, why people are being treated differently, and really what this says about who matters, who has value in our society.
In Stillwater, Charlie's on the phone. Good morning, Charlie.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. For me, I had a trigger experience back when I was a freshman in college. I come from a family with a lot of roots back in the Deep South, and you know, a lot of discrimination against African Americans. Well, I had a housemate, a freshman in college, who was African American guy, a ROTC student, who was like way smarter, way more impressive, way more articulate than me. So I called him Smelly, you know. And more recently, teaching at Metro State University, a lot of smelly immigrants. These people are smart, motivated. I mean, you know, I've been blessed to have lots of great relationships with people that are different than me. And so there are those kind of those trigger moments that really are telling and they're awakening. But I think for me, the takeaway is education, being more broad-minded, being more thoughtful.
Hmm. And so you recognize, you know, based on what you experienced as a child and how you viewed people as a child, it's very different than how you view them now?
Oh, yes. Yes, for sure.
Thank you. That's Charlie in Stillwater calling in. As we talk about bias, let's talk to one of our listeners in St. Paul. This is Karen. Karen, what do you want to tell us about bias?
Hi, Angela.
Hi.
Many years ago, I had a job that involved sitting in the cockpit of Northwest Airlines flights and listening on a headset to the transactions that would occur between the pilots and the air traffic controllers on the ground. And one day we were flying into Memphis, Tennessee, a Northwest hub, and I was listening to the radio transmissions that were very slow and okay. with a southern drawl.
All right.
And I had an epiphany at that moment that because my feeling about what I heard was that that person was not particularly bright or intelligent or capable, which I think was principally because I had interacted with people from all different parts of our country and many other countries and had never felt that way necessarily. But I checked myself and had a light bulb moment and realized that that was a horrific bias that I held. I was raised in the Midwest by two English professors and speak more quickly. But just having that self-recognition has helped me for the next 25 years in being aware of my own bias. And
being self-aware, that is really a big part of this. It's just, you know, having a moment that you become aware.
Absolutely.
Jessica, what are you hearing what she just shared?
Yeah, it's true. And I think that once you start to see what's happening, and you start to name it, then you can actually start to change. So you can't change necessarily how people respond to you, but you can start changing the way that you respond to other people. And you can, you know, that awareness of what's happening is really the beginning of agency. It's the beginning of the ability to change.
That was from a conversation I had earlier this year with author Jessica Nordell, who came out this fall with a new book called The End of Bias, A Beginning. Well, Maya, our time is up for today. Meyer Beckstrom, one of the great producers on this talk show, thank you for sharing some of your favorite shows from 2021. And before we go, Maya, what are some of the ideas that you're knocking around right now? What are you looking forward to producing in 2022?
Well, one of the things I want to do is look a little bit closely at education and frontline, you know, teachers. I think we heard from healthcare workers from that segment earlier in the show, and mm-hmm. I'd like to do something with teachers and school staff, because I think they're really burdened right now.
Okay. They're going through it.
And so that's one of them. And then the other one is a weird one. I want to do something on cooperatives, so co-ops. Minnesota is the land of food co-ops, rural co-ops, and it's becoming more popular as a way to look at solving the housing crisis.
I love it. I'm so glad you're part of the team. Maya Beckstrom, one of our producers here at NPR, who works on this program. All right, be safe, everyone. Join us tomorrow morning at 9.
Support comes from Delta Dental of Minnesota Foundation, making dental care possible for Minnesotans in need by funding nonprofit dental clinics, expanded dental workforce, and school-based programs to improve oral health. DeltaDentalMN.org/NPR.
Programming supported by the Minneapolis Foundation, a community of Minnesotans cultivating generosity together. Open a donor-advised fund or give a year-end gift to the One Minneapolis Fund to support our community's emerging needs. Learn more at MinneapolisFoundation.org.
1A is coming up next here on NPR News, 91.1 KNOW, Minneapolis-St. Paul, discovering what matters. In the first hour of the program, Jen White takes a look at K-dramas. Then at 11, Jen takes up young adult novels. Stay tuned for those conversations. Here in the Twin Cities, snow is likely later this morning with some freezing drizzle possible, an inch to 2 inches of accumulation, high temperatures mid-20s today, east winds 10 to 15. And then for tonight, mostly cloudy skies and much colder with a 20% chance of snow, low temperatures actually below zero.